All right, thanks very much. My name's Mary Sevabos. I work for the Australian Centre for the Study of Sexual Assault. The reason I became interested in prison conditions for women was because I've done a project for one of the corrective services states. I won't tell you which one because it doesn't really matter. And basically, they're seeing a problem in terms of women and recidivism. I don't know that the problem that they're seeing is the same problem I'm seeing, but they've asked for us to do a project on that. We've done that. They're reviewing it at the moment. And I'm interested in writing some more papers about it because I think it's a really important topic, basically. So basically this is around... there's an overview for you. So I'm going to sort of set the scene a little bit with women's histories of child sexual abuse in prison. It's actually very far-reaching. And a little bit more complex than just your usual sort of sexual abuse trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. We're talking about sort of more complex trauma and complex needs. There are definitely tensions in supporting women as victim survivors within a custodial environment. The way I look at it is that women in prison with child sex abuse and sex and physical abuse trauma is that they're working under a dual identity, if you like. The criminal justice system likes to see people in really discrete categories. You're a victim or you're an offender, and these people are both. So I think there's real tensions in supporting them in that environment. And I just want to sort of give a nod to the alternatives and innovations, some of the promising practices perhaps that could happen, some of the integrations that might help. And this isn't just within the prison. It takes in the entire criminal justice system when it comes to sentencing and then community sort of readiness for people to be in the community afterwards. So basically, you know, the main thesis is that women with a sexual abuse history are having a great deal of trouble in prison and are recidivating. Basically what I'm going to go through now is just, this is a non-custodial statistics around, so sort of probation and community sentence sort of vote. And this was done by the Crime and Misconduct Commission in 2007. It had a good representation of non-Indigenous and Indigenous people. This is sort of males and females, as you can see. And this is sexual experiences, unwanted sexual experiences, up to the age of 12. So you're looking at, you know, fairly scary sort of statistics. 33% of females had someone expose themselves. 12% had someone have intercourse with them against their will. So you're starting to see a picture of people who are starting life with quite severe trauma and quite severe sexual, unwanted sexual attention. When it comes to being between 12 and up to age 16, the figures get even more depressing. They're basically, we're looking at coercive sexual experiences. We're looking at sexual experiences based around drugs and alcohol and coercion. Physical coercion, so some of these statistics are really quite extremely high. So basically, the idea in sexual assault is that we understand that if you have a child sexual abuse issue quite early on, what this tends to do is set up more and more experiences of trauma, basically physical and sexual. So we're starting to build a picture of someone who's dealing with a lot of bad stuff all the time. In terms of incarcerated women, this actually comes from a Queensland study from 2008. They asked women about their sexual experiences prior to and during incarceration, but these women are incarcerated. 59% had been forced or frightened into doing something sexually that they didn't want to do. That's, you know, nearly 6 out of 10 women in prison. This is only the picture of people who are telling us as well. Mm-hmm. 57% of them said they didn't seek any help or ask anyone. We know that it's an underreported crime. It's the sort of crime that people don't like to talk about, particularly if you're in a prison and someone's sitting there going, have you had any sexual experiences that are a problem for you? It's a dangerous kind of thing to disclose. And as I said earlier, re-victimisation is really common. It occurs over the life course. So I've got some figures here if you can find them. For this particular group, a third of women had experienced sexual coercion between 3 and 9 times in their life. A further 13% said it had occurred more than 10 times. and 53% had experienced sexual coercion between three and I don't know how many other times. So we're talking about women who get themselves into relationships which are characterised by abuse and exploitation. It's set up for a very difficult life. Polyvictimisation, this is a US-based study. Out of 164 women, 42% had experienced four different types of interpersonal violence, coercion, physical, sexual. The reason this is happening is because sexual victimisation is located within familial and care settings. So basically it's starting in the home and it's continuing in the home. Perpetrators' tactics involving secrecy, complicity and threat means that sometimes these women tend to be what's called willing or complicit victims. So they're setting up a type of behaviour that's going to occur throughout their lives. Now, as I said earlier, a lot of the time sexual abuse trauma is connected to post-traumatic stress disorder, which is about dissociation. They sort of dissociate from where they're at. They've got intrusion, which means the memory plays over and over and over in their heads. And they've also got this memory imprint, which is coming back to them. And they tend to like to stop all this with drugs and alcohol, sometimes with sexual behaviour that's not appropriate for different situations, sometimes through their own violence, sometimes through their own actions. But basically, that's a single kind of trauma thing. When you're talking about complex trauma like I'm talking about today, you're looking at people who have got a great deal of issues. They've got drug use, they've got self-harm, they've got a lot of mental health issues, borderline personality disorder, they've got high-risk sexual behaviours, they've got body problems, they've got aches and pains that they can't understand that have no sort of medical basis. So we're dealing with people who also have social ills, they have difficulty parenting, they have difficulty holding down a job, they tend to look to the average person quite chaotic. Yeah, they're difficult to help, or they seem difficult to help. Okay, so basically what we're seeing is the sexual abuse is the basis, and then you start seeing some of these other issues popping up. Women are starting to sort of fling into institutions. So whether it's the drug and alcohol sector or the mental health sector, as sexual assault services and domestic violence services for re-victimisation, they're basically going into a lot of institutions. Sometimes being chaotic, they tend to be called treatment resistant, and they might ping from different institutions. And then they might go into the criminal justice system as a victim or as an offender, but there seems to be no sort of connection between these two. So they're basically institutionalised but not well supported sometimes. Now, supporting women as victims within a prison environment has inherent sort of tensions. There's a lot of complexity. We know that we need to be supporting women. There's issues around recidivism. They're obviously coming out, they're reoffending, they're going back in, or they're breaching and they're going back in. But there's some issues in doing this within the current system as it stands. For me, systems have been built on a male security risk. I mean, this is just the way things are. I balk a little bit at the term objective, Gary, as I said before, because I just don't think there's a universal system that can measure men and women. I think men and women are equal, but I think they're quite different. They come at it from a different place. And so when we talk about male risk, we talk about risk of misconduct. We talk about risk of violence, which is how we know men enact anger. That's the kind of socially acceptable way. For women, it tends to be more about self-harm, suicide ideation, hurting themselves. So when you're building a system that's based on 80% risk and 20% rehabilitation, and put women in there, that doesn't fit, that doesn't work very well. Basically, prison is a coercive and punitive place. It's supposed to be acting as a punishment. So when corrective services came to us and said, you know, what are we going to do about women with sexual abuse history? Should we just give them some programs? Should we give them some therapy? Those two ideologies don't fit very well in one place. It's a little bit schizophrenic in my mind to sort of say, we're going to punish you, but let's help you as well, but let's punish you, but let's help you. I don't know that that's a very stable environment. The other things that are sort of really impacting on women with a sexual abuse history are things like strip searching and being manhandled. I mean, these are things that send women who have been victimised into a feeling of re-victimisation. Women have explicitly said that they feel like they're being abused again, their power is being taken away from them, and they feel re-victimised. There's been some, especially in Victoria, as you said, it's quite progressive in Victoria. They've got the Better Pathways system, and by all accounts, it's working extremely well. But there are issues of trust in group therapy. Information can be used as currency in prison, and you have to be really, really careful about what you say. If you're going to disclose something, often for women with sexual abuse history, the very act of disclosing can really bring up some of those intrusive memories. And is prison as a punitive environment something that can handle that? Do we have the resources to handle that in prison? I'd sort of question it. I don't think we do. And a lot of the time, the counselling that goes on in prison is probably enough just to support the fact that a woman with trauma is in a prison environment. That's about as much as it can probably do. We're just keeping our heads above the water all the time. Well, we're talking about the importance of economic arguments because that's what seems to work with politicians. I think that's the most interesting figure, and that came out this year. And what we're looking at there is a very, very obvious economic argument. Particularly, I would say, for this group. I can't speak for all groups because I haven't done a lot of research on other groups, but for women with a sexual abuse history, I would say that prison is re-traumatising, it's more expensive, and it's not working. Community corrections, if it was wrangled correctly, might work much better. And at $21 a day, it looks like it's pretty obvious. I think socially as well, Gary touched on this, and I think this is true, that prison is not always a deterrent. Donald Ritchie from the Australian Institute of Criminology talks about that rational theory, the idea that people are sort of committing crimes on this cost and benefit basis. But I've just set up an argument to tell you that women with sexual abuse histories often have great mental health issues. They've got a lot of chaotic problems. They're not making rational decisions. And therefore, how could it possibly be a deterrent to them to put them into prison? It doesn't really make sense. What I think might be better socially, if you look at the literature for women who are not offenders, who are just traumatised, they talk about the need for integrated services. They talk about the need to put drug and alcohol in contact with sexual abuse specific trauma counselling, in contact with parenting support, in contact with etc. etc. So you can do those kind of warm, I hate this phrase, but these warm kind of handovers. You can actually walk someone over and say, I can introduce you to this person. That's the kind of support that these women need, and that's the kind of support that they probably can't get in prison, but probably could outside. Another initiative is that I've been reading about, particularly in the US, is around community justice. Community justice is about having community justice in the community. So one of the biggest ones is called justice reinvestment. Now, they're desperate in the US to reduce their population in prison. They've just got too many people in there. And what they have looked at is redirecting some of the funds that they put into prison and redirecting them into the communities where offenders actually come from. There's actually two specific cases. In Texas, what they did is they started to talk about doing initiatives. They talked to courts and said, you know, can we look at possibly sentencing people to community rather than to prison? Can we look at decreasing the workload for probation and parole community workers so that we've got more of them and they're dealing with less people so they're able to help them much better? They ended up saving, I think in 2005 or 2006, I could be wrong, around $210 million. And they are looking now to put that into the five communities where most of their prison population had come from. When they started doing this, 1% of Texan people were in prison. 1% of their entire population was in prison. So it's a wonderful initiative in terms of what they've been able to do. For Kansas, it's worked a little bit better. I've got some figures that I'll have to read here because I can't remember them off the top of my head. So look, Okay, so Kansas went beyond, they actually put money back in. They started seeing a reduction in their prison population. They had a 7.5% reduction in prison population. They had, their parole revocation is down by 48%. And their reconviction rate for parolees has dropped by 35%. So it's quite heartening that, you know, as we said before, politicians like economic evidence, and they like evidence, they love stats, you know, they get right into that. So if you can show them that you've made an economic difference and you've created a lower percentage of people in prison and everybody in the community is safe, they buy that. That's what they're interested in.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Are you talking men and women?
I'm talking only about women. That's what I've concentrated my study on. Obviously, there are men who are sexually abused with a sexual abuse history, but yeah.
But those stats were from...
Oh, that was the whole population.
The whole population.
Yes, yes, yep. Yeah. There's also some drug diversion programs, and these are pre-sentence. Only one of them's been evaluated properly, and that's the Merritt one in New South Wales. But basically what they're doing there is they're saying if you've got a low-level offence, non-violent offence, and your drug use has anything at all to do with this offence, you can come before the Merritt program, and which is magistrates, so it's for summary offences, and we will basically send you off to an AOD, so an alcohol or other drug program. And if you complete it well, we'll take it into account when we sentence you. This has worked extremely well for women. They've done it in Queensland and they're doing it in Victoria as well. It's basically reduced drug use and reduced rates of reoffending. And again, this is what you want to see. You want to be keeping people out of prison. You want to give them a chance. And you want to see them get off the drugs and start dealing with some of those foundational problems which are causing or leading to offending in the first place. Rather than this idea that there's a deficit, there's something wrong with them, there is, but it's not criminological, it's actually personal, it's societal. So I think when it comes to, and I can only speak really because that's where my research sits, for women with sexual abuse histories, I think there's an excellent argument and a great deal of evidence to show that they can sort of be diverted out of the prison system and into the community. The one thing I'm really interested in as well is thinking about community readiness. I know you guys are saying you were doing a project on that. I'd be interested to talk to you about it because I think that's the last key. I think some of the attitudes that are displayed in the community based around, you know, the media and some of these, you know, very unusual sort of narratives that go on around tough on crime, etc. I think a little bit of community education would be spot on in this area. I don't think you'd get a lot of people saying, no, sexual abuse victims don't deserve our sympathy, because they do. And it's just about setting that up so that the media love it too. I'm not clever enough to do that, but I'm sure there's people out there who are. So yeah, that's basically it. I'm actually writing a paper on this, which, I mean, I work for ACSA, which is Australian Centre for the Study of Sexual Assault. We've got a paper coming out yesterday that talks about sexual abuse in institutions, and prison is one of them. I'm also writing an issues paper which will be out sometime next year around this particular issue, specifically speaking to women's dual identity. And basically that's my email address, so if you're interested in any information you can email me. And that's it. Are there any questions at all? Yeah.
Mary, traditionally women get very